Hey folks, some exciting news from SunsetLakeCBD.com. Longtime sponsor of this program. They are having a big sale tomorrow. It starts at 0 a.m. East, I guess like 12:01 a.m. All CBD products will be 30% off. 30% off with the coupon code ELECTION. 10% of the proceeds from the coupon code ELECTION will go to Planned Parenthood. And the majority report is going to match those 10% of proceeds and donate them to Planned Parenthood, too. Good way to remind you that you got to go out and vote, and good way to remind you as to why. Sunset Lake, CBD, majority report, we're teaming up and turn this election day into a fundraiser for Planned Parenthood. Reproductive rights are human rights, and we're putting our money where our mouth is. Here's how it works. Visit SunsetLakeCBD.com on Tuesday, November 8th, starting really at 12:01 a.m. tonight, I guess, right? I'm trying to work that out. Yes. All CBD products will be 30% off with the code ELECTION through midnight tomorrow night. We'll probably still be on air.
Yeah.
We'll be talking about this tomorrow, too, to remind you. 10% of all proceeds from election sales will be donated to Planned Parenthood. Folks, I've talked about all these products. The tinctures, the smokables, the gummies, both with just CBD, with CBD and melatonin, CBD and TSA as well. The gummies are all awesome. The fudge, the coffee, all of it. The salve, can't recommend these products more than I do. Sunset Lake CBD is a majority-owned employee business, pays a minimum wage of $20 an hour. This past year, Sunset Lake CBD donated more than $26,000 to anti-drug war organizations, to animal shelters, union strike funds, nature conservation, food shelves, refugee resettlement organizations, and more. Again, tomorrow, Tuesday, November 8th only, all CBD products 30% off with the coupon code ELECTION. Visit SunsetLakeCBD.com. Take advantage of this deal. Help raise money for Planned Parenthood. Some restrictions may apply. And now, the show.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Monday, November 7th. 7th, 2022. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, professor of history at Vanderbilt University, Nicole Hemmer, author of Partisans, the conservative revolutionaries who remade American politics in the 1990s. Meanwhile, we are one day out from Election Day, and you know, we'll see.
Yep.
John Ralston, sort of the dean of Nevada politics, journalist, predicts Masto Cortez will win in Nevada, which is a big deal if it happens. Washington Post poll shows things neck and neck. Georgia has record early voting, though some say a libertarian candidate may push it into a runoff. Meanwhile, the Republican early vote strategy has become clear. Push their voters to vote on Election Day. Sue to disqualify as many early votes as possible. Florida, meanwhile, has banned doctors from prescribing gender care to patients under the age of 18. Freedom. Twitter delays pay for blue check until after midterms. Maybe they watched our little talk on this Friday. Meanwhile, there's a new terms of service. No mocking Lonnie Musk.
No.
And they rehired some of the people they fired because Elon Musk.
Well, I hope those rehired employees are documenting everything.
Oh, please. COP27 opens in Egypt as the Colorado River is now in a state of emergency. We could see massive water shortages for more than 40 million people in the Southwest. Biden administration reportedly in quiet talks with Russian officials to avoid a nuclear war. Also, they have sought Ukrainian public openness to negotiations to quiet, I guess, growing impatience from other allies around the world. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. It is Monday, like I said, November 7th. What do we call Mondays around here again?
I don't think we have a name
day.
For it.
Fun day.
I thought that was, yeah, well, I was, that's not Sunday because we don't work on Sunday. Never mind.
Emma Vigeland.
I guess it is Monday fun day.
Emma Vigeland here with us with on Monday fun day. We're all a little slow today, I guess.
I definitely am. And so are you.
I am too. Yeah, I'm not going to lie. And tomorrow, a big day, obviously. I mean, in some respects, it's really just, I don't know if it's going to be a big day. We may not know the results that we want to know until Wednesday or Thursday for that matter.
Oh, yeah. Fetterman's team's already kind of sending out warnings to voters in Pennsylvania. We're probably not going to know the results for a while.
Pennsylvania is one of those states where Republicans have sued to disqualify thousands of ballots because of a failure to put the date on the outside of the ballot, even though these ballots have already arrived in front of on Tuesday. Right. I mean, the purpose of the date is to make sure that they have voted in time. The ballots are all there. They could easily be certified as arrived before the election. Federal courts may have an issue with that because technicalities are not supposed to disqualify ballots. And prior to the day, November 8th this year, the dating on these ballots is a technicality, right? Because they know, election officials know that these ballots are in before November 8th. However, we shall see. I mean, you know, we had mentioned a couple of weeks ago that in Wisconsin, there were heavily Republican counties where Republican officials are saying vote on day of. And now we see they are suing mm-hmm. to get rid of some of the early ballots. So this is one of the strategies. And remember, these are states where, at least in the context of the presidential elections, you know, you're talking 10,000, 20,000, you know, maybe 40,000 max are the differences. And think about that in terms of like a congressional race where, you know, 1,000 votes could easily make the difference in a couple of these congressional races. So stay tuned for that. One of the things that we talked about on Friday with Digby was what we were seeing from the mainstream media in framing this election like it's an absolute done deal for the Republicans, both the House and the Senate. And there's been an influx of crappy polls. And the right has been pushing this narrative. And one of the things that Digby pointed out was that, you know, what this does is it sets the Republican voter up for the narrative that if this isn't a big night for Republicans tomorrow night, then it's a function of voter fraud. And here is Ben Shapiro, the Pope of the Jews, here to make a proclamation that indeed, yes, if Republicans don't win tomorrow, big, that's going to be very suspicious.
Now, it's important to remember here, for those who don't understand how percentages work, 55% shot does not mean 100% shot. People tend to think, well, at 49% shot, Republicans were going to take the Senate. This means they'll definitely lose the Senate. At 51%, that means they'll definitely take the Senate. No, it means that if you run the simulation 100 times, Republicans win in 55 of them, but in 45, Democrats win. So, you know, pretending that this thing is a surefire bet for Republicans is wrong. However, is the momentum with the Republicans? Absolutely. The momentum is with the Republicans, and this is why Democrats are spending heavily in blue areas. By Republicans are spending almost nothing in red areas. And, you know, again, it's going to be fascinating to see what happens because so many of these races are apparently close. It feels like the momentum is moving all in one direction. With that said, a lot of these polls are still extraordinarily close.
I mean, let's honestly, okay, I know that we talk about this in those terms too, but what does it mean to feel like the momentum is going in one direction?
After he says it's absolutely on the Republican side, so it feels like, and it's also absolutely a fact.
It's absolutely feeling like it.
He's not Dave Weigel, like, on the campaign trail, kind of getting sense. Neither are we, but that's why we have Dave Weigel on, to talk about that. Like, his sense of the momentum is just, you know, inherently
his spidey
partisan.
Senses are right. Picking this up. Now, I should say, you know, Washington Post ABC poll came out today. Basically, it was like 49-48, you know, well within the margin of error of, are you going to vote for a Republican or you vote for a Democrat? I mean, so, and he's even saying, like, it's really, really close. But it absolutely feels like something. But you know what, Ben? Someone once said, facts don't care about your feelings. Mm. Continue.
It's going to be fascinating to see what happens because so many of these races are apparently close. It feels like the momentum is moving all in one direction. With that said, a lot of these polls are still extraordinarily close. So if there's a polling error in the other direction, theoretically, the red wave could founder. I will say one thing that's going to be very dangerous for the country. There's a widespread perception that Republicans are going to kick ass in the House and that they are likely to take the Senate at this point. If suddenly this turns into a wipeout in favor of Democrats, if you're worried about election denial and you're worried about people not trusting the results of elections, if people go to bed on Tuesday night thinking the Republicans have won, and by Wednesday morning, Democrats have picked up a bunch of seats and the red wave has foundered on the rocks, there's going to be a lot of discontent in this country, and it's going to be driven by a lot of the media coverage of what's going on so far.
Like you.
As well as a lot of uncertainty about how votes are even tabulated.
Luckily, you have a platform with millions and millions of viewers, Ben, where you can correct the record and say that is just the trajectory of votes being counted.
Yeah, it sounds like your problem, Ben. Like,
right.
Deal with your audience.
I mean, why are you stepping back away from it and saying, well, some people are going to be feeling this? Well, then you have a responsibility as the truth teller who's giving people facts to give them the facts of the situation and how votes are going to be tabulated.
I mean, it is. It's also, we should remember, like, when the last election that we had in 2000, and it felt like we saw what happened in California.
Yeah.
In terms of, I mean, so we know that he knows that in fact people are going to go to bed thinking that Republicans did better than they did, because we now know that the Republicans had a specific strategy not to vote early. Those ballots are tabulated often after the fact because Republican legislators have made it impossible by statute to count these ballots before Election Day. And so they know that the Democratic votes are going to come in later. And he knows that people are going to go to bed and things will probably look better for Democrats. It could look just horrible for Democrats and a little bit less horrible by the next day. But in terms of a trend, to the extent that past is any sort of like indication as to what's going to happen in this election, we know that things are going to get a little bit better for Democrats over the course of that evening into the next morning. So he knows that's going to happen. And it's like this sort of like vague, I don't know, I can't tell if it's like a threat or if it's like some type of like encouragement that people should be outraged. Like, here's your license to be outraged if you don't like the way that votes are counted. And yes, when you talk about the media narrative, dude, I mean,
you can combat it then. You don't need to kind of just view it through this kind of passive lens. Just tell us the facts, Ben. That's
right,
what you're here
exactly.
For.
Exactly. Continue.
There's going to be a lot of discontent in this country, and it's going to be driven by a lot of the media coverage of what's going on so far, as well as a lot of uncertainty about how votes are even tabulated in states like Pennsylvania, which takes like days and days and days to tabulate the votes.
Because of a law passed by the Republican Pennsylvania legislature That's why. And he knows it. That's why Fetterman has been out there saying, like, this may take a while, because he's trying to change expectations. But to the extent that, like, he's blaming the media narrative, which he has already said feels like there's Republican momentum, you're the one promoting that narrative. It's fascinating that he can have both those things go on simultaneously is impressive. All right. Couple words from our sponsors before we get to Nicole Hemmer, who has written a book, Partisans, the Conservative Revolutionaries Who Remade American Politics in the 1990s. One of our sponsors today, Ritual. Ritual is a company that was founded by a skeptical mom. She didn't trust the multivitamins that were out there. And the thing that Ritual does that nobody else does is it is the first of its kind traceable supply chain. So you can see where all of your key ingredients come from and why they are there. Their flagship multivitamin has USP certification and a peer-reviewed and published clinical study. Plus, all of Ritual's products are vegan and non-GMO and third-party tested, so you know you can trust them. I am a user of the over 50 for men. Ritual. Yep, there we go. That was fun to watch that happen. But it is great. Ritual's multivitamins, they're specifically formulated to help fill nutrient gaps in the diet, which I clearly have many. Key ingredients like vitamin D3 and vegan omega-3 DHA. I think that omega-3 DHA is good for your brain. And the D3, hugely important for someone like me who spends, you know, as much time as I can indoors without any sunlight. And for years, my doctor was like, you're vitamin D deficient. Take some vitamin D. And I would do it, and I would take it for however long that first bottle lasted, and then I was done. But the beautiful thing about Ritual is that they send it to you every month. So you get on a program, and it means they send it to you, and you don't forget. That's the beauty for me. Sent straight to your door. You never have to worry about running out. And then, for me, you never have to worry about getting out of the habit of taking a multivitamin. Ritual is also a certified B Corporation, believes doing good for your health means doing good for the planet. And I should also say, super easy on the stomach. They have a delayed release capsule, apparently that is why that is the case. Nothing but good things to say about Ritual. Check it out. Start a vitamin ritual you can trust. To get started, visit ritual.com/majority today. Get 10% off your first three orders. That's ritual.com/majority to start your new ritual today. We'll put the link in the podcast and YouTube subscription description. Also, going online without ExpressVPN, it's like leaving your kids with the nearest stranger while using the restroom. Well, yes, tempting, but ultimately you should not do it.
Saul has some thoughts on...
Yeah, tempting, but you should not do that.
Right.
Most of the time, it's probably fine. You never know who you're trusting. So there you go.
Good to know.
Don't risk the important things. Start using ExpressVPN today. Every time you connect to an encrypted network, your online data is not secured. Any hacker on the same network can gain access and steal your personal data. I mean, passwords, financial details, you name it. ExpressVPN creates a secure encrypted tunnel between your device and the internet so that hackers can't steal your data and sell your personal info on the dark web. It's super easy. You fire up the app, you click on the button, you're instantly protected. ExpressVPN works on all your devices, your laptops, your phones, your tablets. You can stay secure on the go. Super easy. Here's the thing why I like ExpressVPN. You know, they ask, like, how has it changed your browsing habits? It hasn't. The only thing is I don't have anxiety or less anxiety or anxiety specifically about my where I'm going here. I don't worry
You've
about...
You've eliminated a source of your anxiety.
I have eliminated one source of my anxiety, and it's also super easy to do. I always thought that having a VPN would be intimidating or something. Like, I don't know. You hear VPN, and you just like, I can't deal with one more acronym. Honestly, one press of the button, and you don't even know you're using it. It's great that way. Secure your online data today at expressvpn.com/majority. You get 3 extra months free. That's expressvpn.com/majority, expressvpn.com/majority. And finally, no-brainer. We'll talk about the one thing that might be missing from your daily routine, hydration. Liquid IV fuels your everyday well-being by helping you stay hydrated. In just one stick, you get 5 essential vitamins, and you're hydrating 2 times faster than water alone. It's cooler weather, supposedly. Makes it easier for you to miss signs of dehydration, like overheating or perspiration. So even more important to stay hydrated. With Liquid IV, you get 3 times the electrolytes of traditional sports drinks. It's non-GMO. It's free from gluten, dairy, and soy. When I'm going to, it's always got baseball, or he's got skateboarding, or whatever he's doing, I will bring his little water bottle with some Liquid IV. Plus, Liquid IV is on a mission to change the world. And to date, the company has donated over 25 million servings, plus in 50-plus countries around the world. Today, I made a controversial move on my Liquid IV. I know you were going to say tangerine. No, watermelon. It's like 70 degrees out.
Oh, yeah.
And I came in this morning. I'm like, I can't believe how hot it is out. I'm going for the watermelon. And bingo, there it is. So that's why I raised, like, you know, the perspiration. I have to talk about my son because I don't ever sweat because I don't exert myself in that way.
Okay, gotcha.
But every day during the show, at least one of these. Grab your Liquid IV in bulk nationwide at Costco or get 20% off when you shop Better Hydration at liquidiv.com. Use the code MAJORITYREP at checkout. That's MAJORITYREP. 20% off anything with the code MAJORITYREP. Not report. MAJORITYREP at liquidiv.com. Okay, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll be talking to Nicole Hemmer, professor of history at Vanderbilt University, author of Partisans, the Conservative Revolutionaries Who Remade American Politics in the 1990s. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. Joining us, Nicole Hemmer, professor of history at Vanderbilt University, author of Partisans, the Conservative Revolutionaries Who Remade American Politics in the 1990s. Nicole, welcome. I'm here with Emma Viglin.
Thank you so much for having me.
The overview of your book, it is basically talking about that time, moving from the Reagan era into, I guess, what is the beginning of this era that we're in now in terms of Republican and conservative thought. Let's just go back and talk about what characterized the Reagan era for us and make a distinction, if you will, if there is one, which I think there is to some extent, between sort of the ideological and the sort of, I guess you would call it the, just dispositional, maybe, of the party at that time.
Well, the big difference is that the Reagan era was one in which you had a president and a party that believed that you could build massive majorities using conservatism. So they believed that conservatism had to be popular, it had to be optimistic in order to build these big majorities. And of course, Reagan still used negative campaigning. He still leaned into racial stereotypes. But he tried to keep that kind of optimistic, pragmatic conservatism at the forefront because he wanted to win in those big landslide elections, which is exactly what he does in 80 and 84. It's what George H.W. Bush does in 88. And that is replaced in the 1990s with a group of political activists who want to use conservatism to divide, to polarize the electorate. And so there is something quite distinct about the party of, say, Ronald Reagan and the party of Newt Gingrich.
Is that also, like, could you draw a line and say a party that was attempting to win over the majority, as you say, to, like, a party that behaves with the urgency of a minoritarian party, which is what we see now?
Absolutely. And you can see that in the different ways that they use power, right? That Ronald Reagan was seeking out kind of the sweet spot where he could still push through conservative policies, but where he would float an idea. And if it was really unpopular, he would back away from it. This happened with attempts to roll back the Voting Rights Act, for instance. Whereas by the time you get to Newt Gingrich, what is he doing? He's innovating in all of these different kinds of congressional obstruction, the longest government shutdown in history at that point, all sorts of investigations, often led by conspiracy theories, the impeachment of Bill Clinton. All of these were kind of novelties for using Congress to obstruct rather than to govern.
What was it that was happening during the Reagan era that led to the Gingrich era, if you will? I mean, because I remember Morning in America with Reagan, where it was all like his whole, you know, I just have images of like the sun shining at that time, and it caused a realignment. I mean, that's what I was told by my professors at the time. We're in an era of realignment. Things have changed in that respect. And again, like, you know, from the policy standpoint, he would back off stuff. He raised taxes in terms of Social Security taxes. He gave what people call amnesty now to 4 or 5 million immigrants. I mean, and those are just those are the highlight ones. But what was going on underneath? And certainly it was exacerbated by George Herbert Walker Bush, who was really not of the same ilk as Reagan ideologically, it feels like.
Oh, that's exactly right. So one of the big things that was shaping the politics of the 80s that changes in the 90s is that the Cold War ends. I mean, Ronald Reagan, you mentioned immigration. He truly believed in the free movement of goods and people as part of what democracy was, how the U.S. distinguished itself from the closed systems of communism. So that was something that he leaned into based on the geopolitics of the time. And the Cold War comes to an end, and suddenly that need to appeal to democracy, that need to appeal to freedom is different. But you're also in a different media environment. The rise of cable news and talk radio is happening in the 1990s that rewards outrage and over-the-top kind of political rhetoric and approaches. So that's changing at the time. There really is a sense that the things that were holding that Reagan majority together are coming apart in some ways. And what's happening with Bush is particularly interesting because you mentioned all the ways that Reagan was kind of pragmatic, or didn't necessarily keep to the conservative line. He's criticized by a lot of conservatives for that, but at the same time, he's Reagan. So the criticisms don't necessarily stick. When they make those same complaints about George H.W. Bush, they stick because they don't see him as a conservative true believer. So all of that is helping melt the Reagan consensus into something else.
Reagan was, at the time, people were talking about how he was Teflon and nothing would stick to him. But everything seemed to stick to George Herbert Walker Bush. And they were pissed about Souter. They were pissed about him making a big deal about no new taxes. Read my lips. And here are the new taxes. To the extent that, and then, I remember the 92 convention. And I can't remember the sequencing. This is, I guess, the way to talk about Pat Buchanan, but Pat Buchanan represented something that was happening sort of underground between Reagan and, you know, through Reagan, but it really began to blossom during H.W. Bush. I remember Dan Quayle had to come out because of Buchanan and Attack Murphy Brown, which was a TV show because she wanted to have a child on her own. And this was the culture war. This is like, was this the first time that the culture war was articulated as being a culture war with Buchanan?
Yeah, so there had clearly been culture wars in America in its history before, but Buchanan really gave it a sharpness and a way of talking about it as a war, as he put it, a war for the soul of America. That's the line that he uses in that very famous 1992 convention speech. And, you know, he had been eyeing running for president in 1988, but at the time, like, the Reagan legacy was too strong. By 1992, after 4 years of Bush, he seizes the moment. And there is this sense, as you mentioned, with Dan Quayle, as you would see in the 1992 Republican convention with a call for structures on the border, which was picking up Pat Buchanan's anti-immigrant line from his primary campaign, that there was a kind of capitulation of the party to these elements that were more radical. It's George H.W. Bush inviting Rush Limbaugh to the White House in 92 to win his support. There's this sense that these aren't voices that you can ignore, that you have to bring them in. And in some ways, you have to follow their lead.
Is Buchanan just simply the heir to sort of like Goldwater and the so-called paranoid style of American politics that, you know, to the extent that that exists on the right? I mean, is he just the heir to that? And it's almost like midwifed on some level through Reagan. And then this sort of like frustration where Bush is sort of tacking back away from that, the frustration grows.
Well, he's certainly the heir to an earlier version of conservatism. You might go back to like the 1930s, 1940s. He uses America First as one of his campaign slogans in a very deliberate call to the Isolationist America First Committee of 1939, 1940. So he's calling on that old right before the Cold War. So that's an important part. But he's also calling on another strain in American politics that's less Barry Goldwater than it is George Wallace, that's right, trying to pick up on that white resentment and frustration and discontent that starts to mobilize around things like school desegregation and the Equal Rights Amendment and gay rights in the 1970s. And Buchanan zeroes in on that anger and outrage and puts it into this older conservative ideological framework of isolationism, protectionism. And that's sort of his model for governing.
And we should say, this is not to say that Reagan wasn't sort of nurturing that as well by Neshoba County, you know, opening his.
Absolutely.
But it was, Buchanan's heart was really in it.
Yeah. Buchanan's heart was really in it, yes. And the difference between Buchanan and Reagan is Reagan goes to Neshoba County. He talks about states' rights. Pat Buchanan goes to Stone Mountain, Georgia, and talks about his Confederate ancestors and the glory of the Confederate South. And that's a difference of a kind.
Yeah. And I think people forget that Bush invited Limbaugh. Now, Limbaugh at this point is also an important character in your story. He starts in 1988, largely helped by the reversal, I guess, the removal of the Fairness Doctrine under Ronald Reagan, because suddenly talk radio can then have what they call format purity, and he can build off this. They can, local stations can have their local versions, their mini Limbaughs after a while, and he gets really big really quickly. And I mean, people forget that he was that important in the early 90s.
He was a phenomenon unlike anything anyone had ever seen before. You know, he started on radio, as you mentioned, as a national host in 88, helped in part by regulatory changes, but also by technological changes that make it possible to have this live simulcast show across the nation where people can call in. And so it gives it that interactive kind of populist feel. 91, 92, he's got best-selling books. He's starting his own television show that was produced by Roger Ailes in 1992. This kind of multimedia, conservative, entertainment show had never been seen like this before. And it just wasn't clear how much power he was actually going to have. But Bush, in inviting him to the White House, gives him an incredible amount of power within the Republican Party and the conservative movement.
And Bush has got to do that because he's worried about his right flank at that point, and he's trying to get his bona fides. All right, so let's move into sort of the Gingrich, the ascent of Gingrich. I mean, I remember that people were talking about impeaching Bill Clinton the day before he took office, like literally that time. And I think people also forget this. He did not win with the majority of votes. He had a plurality of the votes, but he didn't win with a majority. And I feel like that element, the sense that, you know, the Republicans lost because, and I don't know if it's true or not. I don't know. I haven't seen anything that I consider definitive as to, you know, who Ross Perot took votes from more in that election. But there was a tremendous anger towards Bill Clinton, in part because, you know, he represented the hippies because he didn't fight in Vietnam. And his wife was saying, I'm not going to stay in the kitchen and bake cakes. And Hillary Clinton and he hadn't won with a majority. And so they were talking about impeaching him on day one.
That's right. And it takes a while for that to really take hold in Congress. But even before Bill Clinton's reelection in 1996, you have members of Congress like Bob Barr who are starting to float this idea of impeachment, particularly if Bill Clinton is reelected. And in the meantime, they're helping to develop and feed all of these conspiracy theories about the Clintons and the ways that they have illegitimately seized power over the course of decades. And that could be from accusations that he was leading a drug ring out of the governor's mansion in Arkansas. It could be that they had, as the Clinton body count conspiracy suggested, just a huge number of people that they killed on their path to power. But that idea of illegitimacy was fed even before Congress took up impeachment. The interesting thing about Gingrich is that he was pretty slow to act on impeachment because he felt that he could work with what was a pretty, if not conservative, then the moderate Clinton presidency. But there was a right flank in the Republican caucus, people who called themselves the true believers, who kept pushing for impeachment and kept pushing. And ultimately, that's where Gingrich ended up.
Where did that come from? Like, where did that right flank essentially like develop? Was this are we like, even as late as 1992-3, are we seeing sort of that ripple effect from the Civil Rights Act? I mean, because it feels like that, like, you know, Johnson said we've lost them for two generations, the South. I mean, it turns out a little bit longer than that, but was that like the sort of like the shockwave still coming where, you know, people on the ground were starting to realize, like, hey, wait a second, the Democrats are not the Democrats that I grew up with, that, you know, Rob Byrd, what's he doing? Like, how come he's not wearing a hood anymore? I mean, that type of thing.
Oh, it's definitely a part of it. It's a backlash not only to the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act, but to immigration reform in 1965. It's still a backlash to the Great Society and the growth of affirmative action. It's in the 1990s when you start to see some of the results of those policies. You see in the 1980s, Jesse Jackson running for president. You see a woman on the presidential ticket for the first time in the 1980s. You see Anita Hill coming forward with accusations of sexual harassment and being taken seriously in 1991 in the confirmation hearings for Clarence Thomas. And so there is this sense that the country is changing in fundamental ways. You're starting to see the decline of a white majority during the Reagan era of like 86%, and that is going to be declining over the course of the 1990s. And so all of those forces are being weaponized by political actors. They're being pushed into, and you have people like Buchanan who are pointing to, say, immigrants and saying, oh, those are the people who are responsible for the problems in your lives. They're responsible for crime. They're responsible for the economy. They're responsible for the fact that you don't feel as good about your place in society as you used to. And that was a very powerful message. And it's something that with the help of conservative media, with the help of conservatives who were disgruntled because they felt Ronald Reagan and Bush didn't go far enough, that you have the right leaning even further right in order to both operate well in this media environment, but also to attract those most vocal and active parts of their base who are particularly fearful or resentful or opposed to the changes happening in the United States.
How much of that shift just was, one, to accommodate this kind of new angry white man backlash, but also because they were in the minority, it's almost like they came, or because they had a Democratic president, it's almost like they came up with this strategy or fell into it, and now they have not really looked back in terms of the rhetoric being more extreme and that also changing the complexion of the party and the priorities of the party?
Well, there absolutely is an effort, especially in 1994, to win over the angry white male. It's in this moment that that phrase, angry white male, becomes ubiquitous in American politics. And it's not just Republicans who are going after that vote. It's Democrats as well. But as Democrats are moving to the right on things like immigration and on crime policy, Republicans are moving even further to the right to differentiate themselves and pick up that angry white male vote. And so you see people who are running for Congress as Republicans in 1994, reaching out to militia members, trying to attract those groups that are especially active in politics in the 1990s. And part of it is that they are deliberately trying to attract the angry white male. And part of it is that once they have attracted a further right fringe, they find themselves like constantly being pulled to the right, and they lose control of their party as it begins to move further and further to the right.
I get the dynamic where the further the Democrats move to the right, the more the Republicans move to the right to differentiate themselves. Which came first, though? Which came first? Or was it just sort of like so slow that it was hard to sort of like measure until it hits some type of like, I don't know, terminal velocity?
It can be difficult to disaggregate because there are so many things that are happening in the U.S. in 1993 and 1994 that it's hard to pull apart, because you have this odd dynamic where in like 93 and early 94, you also have both the Democrats and Republicans trying to win over the Perot vote. And the Perot vote, which is angry and anti-establishment, but is also heterodox. And, you know, Perot was in favor of abortion. He was in favor of gun regulation. So it doesn't necessarily suggest that it was inevitable that everybody was going to be moving to the right. You could have moved in more of this heterodox Perot direction. That's not where the parties go. But I think that it is, in particular, the vocalness of these right-wing activists, for instance, the local right-wing activists in California who pushed for Proposition 187 and used very racist language about immigrants from Mexico in order to push that proposition forward, they're moving to the right on immigration, and it's the Democratic Party that's following them. So sometimes it differs by issue, and sometimes it's not playing out exactly that way, right? You know, the Democrats are supportive of gun regulation, the Republican Party moves hard against gun regulation in 93 and 94. So on some issues, they're moving apart. But on some, the Democratic Party is kind of following the Republicans.
And we should say, Perot was, his big issue was NAFTA. That it was going to, he famously said, you know, you're going to hear a giant sucking sound, and that's going to be the jobs that get poured out of the country. And taking this sort of very... in many respects, I thought he was a loon, and he kept jumping in and out of the race literally over the course of the summer. But he was largely right in at least like sensing, A, the potential for NAFTA to harm the American worker, and B, that this was going to be an issue, that this outsourcing issue was going to be relevant, and it has obviously been for the past 30 years. And it seemed like neither party adopted that mantle at all until, you know, to the extent that either party has in any real way, or at least paid lip service to it, until like 20 years later, 25 years later.
That's exactly right. I mean, both Buchanan and Perot saw in NAFTA something where there was an elite bipartisan consensus, right? NAFTA was drafted by Republicans. It was signed into law by Bill Clinton, and people were really frustrated with it. Some people really liked it, but there was a faction of Americans who were strongly against NAFTA and did not see representation for their view in either major party. And as you mentioned, that would continue for quite some time. And it's part of the reason why people like Pat Buchanan remain relevant over the course of the 90s and into the 2000s, because in those places where you have this elite bipartisan consensus and nobody is really challenging it, it opens up a door for somebody like Buchanan to become the voice of this dissatisfied, underrepresented group of people.
And I want to, obviously, Don, I want to skip this whole era during the Bush years, but I mean, there are two things that just stick out for me is that, you know, Clinton had promised after NAFTA was going to be followed up with worker and environmental protections in Mexico, you know, as a subsequent add-on that never materialized. And the other thing is I jumped through that it makes me really it reminds me of Barack Obama pushing the TPP in 2016, like literally pushing this NAFTA style, in many respects more massive, almost like, you know, like NAFTA, but, you know, grown up and more monstrous in many respects. During the summer, during that election, and like literally pushing it up until, you know, it became completely untenable. And that was a huge boon to Donald Trump in states like Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, which just so happened to be the three states that gave him the election by 70,000 votes.
And that was another moment where you could see that lack of representation having a real effect, because the writing was on the wall. I mean, I do think that Barack Obama very much believed in the Trans-Pacific Partnership, but you had seen Bernie Sanders surge into a competitive position during the 2016 primaries. You see Hillary Clinton begin to shift her position on TPP over the course of the 2016 election. So it's clear that things are shifting, but I think for Barack Obama, he really believed that this was going to be part of his legacy and that he was doing the right thing. But the consensus behind that position, to the extent it ever existed, was very quickly crumbling under his feet.
But I mean, as a political matter, I mean, I personally think that TPP is highly problematic. But and I believe he was sincere in his belief, you know, that that's what we should do. I think he was sincere in a lot of beliefs that I think were ultimately shown to be wrong based upon who was advising him. And we should say the chief negotiator for that was the same Citibank executive who gave him a list of potential cabinet people in the summer of or fall of 2008 that Robert Rubin had probably helped him write. And they all landed in that administration. They're also the ones who designed the response to the financial crisis, et cetera, et cetera. But as a pure political matter, the tone deafness to that issue is striking, it seems to me. Mm-hmm. And Donald Trump, the least sort of like populist human being outside of affectation in, you know, that we could have, you know, a billionaire supposedly, is able to pick that up and at the very least, you know, pretend to be a man of the people.
Well, Perot also kind of using those same trappings, right?
That's true.
Right.
Yeah, Perot was a billionaire tech executive who ran for president without any sort of political experience. So it really is a model there. And I think you're exactly right that the politics were all wrong in that moment. And I think that it reveals something both about the administration's belief that Trump couldn't win, that he wasn't somebody to worry about, but also a kind of ideological belief that Obama had, that the president could be above politics and would be rewarded for that. And I don't think that that was borne out during his presidency.
No. All right. So let's go back to Clinton happens. This, it's almost like taking, I don't know, some mold and putting it in like a damp area as it grows in terms of Gingrich. And this becomes just a massive machine. Bush wins. I mean, not the popular vote, but the popular one on the Republican Supreme Court. And so what happens during the Bush years? Because Bush comes back in, he tries to do sort of more like Reagan compassionate conservatism, he called it.
That's exactly right. And if you look back at the publications at the time of his victory, you see newspapers calling him George W. Reagan, saying that he was the son of George H.W. Bush, but he was the heir to Reagan, that he had picked up that mantle. Even though, again, like he wasn't building consensus through conservatism, but he was open to immigration reform. He was focused at times on education. And even with his foreign policy after 9/11, this idea that he was forged in the fires of this ideological conflict and that he would lead the nation forward with toughness through it. So that kind of Reagan-esque, all of those sort of mythologies about Reagan begin to adhere to him along with the massive tax cuts that he passes through in his first year. And what do you see by the end of the Bush administration? You see the global financial collapse. You see the cost of deregulation and those massive tax cuts. You see Hurricane Katrina, and the idea that I'm from the government and I'm here to help is actually kind of a good thing and not the scariest words in the English language. You see Iraq and Afghanistan devolving into the decades-long debacles that they were. And so this idea that he was trying out Reaganism again, and that it ended in such clear bipartisan failure, was in many ways kind of the death knell of Reaganism, and really does open the floodgates for this other kind of conservatism that somebody like Pat Buchanan had championed in the early 1990s.
It's funny. There's two things that strike. Like, I would love to know the last time Grover Norquist called for Ronald Reagan to be on the head of a dime. I think it was. They were pushing this. People don't. I mean, during those aughts, you still had let's put Reagan on Mount Rushmore, and now nobody talks about Reagan at all. But I do. There were two things that strike me that Bush came in with a more Buchanan-like policy, or at least stance. No nation building. Mm-hmm. And then that changed on 9/11. And I think, you know, Cheney certainly had a different ideas going into that. But I was at the 2004 convention as on Radio Row, and some guy saddled up next to me, didn't know, you know, anything about Air America, who I was with at the time, just assumed we were right wingers because why else would we be on radio? And he came up to me and he goes, like, this crew of Bush people, they're all Jews. Now, I'm a Buchanan type of person. I was like,
came up to you and said,
yeah,
that?
And I said, I got news for you. I'm a Jew type of person. But I was really struck on how at that time, and I remember, you know, CPAC at that time, where people like George Bush is not conservative enough, and they were mad about Harriet Myers. They were really worried that Bush was going to put a suitor on there. They were going to sort of play the game with abortion and never deliver. And that seemed to sort of like rekindle. I just remember college students at CPAC just, you know, getting really angry about George Bush. And that anger was coming from somewhere. And it seems to me like all the Gen Xers who grew up under Reagan and saw like a specific element of Reagan gave that to their kids on the right. And it created these sort of like Alex P. Keaton monsters, essentially.
Very much so. And I think that you're right that that discontent was there. It was, you remember the sort of anti-Muslim movement that was so rampant on the right during the Bush years, even as George W. Bush was calling for more compassion, calling for people to be good to their Muslim neighbors, setting that aside from the actual policies that he had. There was this very intense anti-Muslim movement. You talked about CPAC. There was a lot of debate over whether Pamela Geller would be allowed there or not, and some divisions that were happening there. You see Bush push for immigration reform, and his administration had not realize the level of antipathy toward that, the level of anger over the idea that you would have immigration reform and a path to citizenship. So the Bush administration doesn't really see this right-wing backlash coming, but it is there throughout his presidency. And you see, for instance, in 2008, when Ron Paul runs for president, Richard Spencer and a bunch of these paleo-libertarians and people who will be leaders for a brief while in what would call itself the alt-right, they're all ready to seize that moment of the post-Bush moment and the unpopularity of the Republican establishment and put forward what they see as a different, truer type of conservatism that can be more open and honest about things like Jewish people and Black people. And they are ready to lean into that moment.
And you write about not just Limbaugh, but you write about like Ann Coulter and Dinesh D'Souza, who actually dated in college, I think, at Dartmouth. Laura Ingraham, who I think also came from, I mean, Dartmouth was really turning them out at that time. But when you talk about that the immigration reform that Bush was trying to push, because he and Karl Rove really understood that the Republican Party needed and felt that they could connect with at least a certain amount of Latinos, it was like guys like it was like Ingraham and Mark Levin and sort of all of that crew that really killed immigration reform. And there was it was amazing to me that the Bush administration did not realize or was not doing. Well, like what happened with that cleave? How did they not see that coming when his dad had to, you know, feed, Limbaugh 10 years earlier? How did they not see that coming?
I think in part they just weren't tapped in to the Republican base. They didn't take seriously conservative media. And Bush had that moment of such intense high popularity. And then he had won re-election. He finally won his majority. And there was this sense that the right was just going to be on his side. And they weren't paying attention to alternative media. They weren't reading blogs, which in the Bush era was where a lot of this discontent was being made visible. They weren't really listening. They were talking to conservative talk radio hosts, but they were mostly talking to people like Limbaugh. And it's not until they start to lose Laura Ingraham and Sean Hannity that they invite them to the White House and try to win them back. But they're just not paying close enough attention because I think they took for granted that Bush would have this continued support. And it really is only in like 2005 with the Harriet Myers scandal, 2006 when the Republicans lose the both houses of Congress, that you really see that backlash start to crystallize and become even more visible because Bush has lost so much power and isn't able to run for election again. So there's no need to support him anymore. But I think by and large, everything that I've seen is that they weren't keeping tabs on the base of their party.
What was happening with the Democrats in your estimation? There's no analog for the Democrats to what talk radio means to the Republicans. Is there? I mean, I've never been able to sort of see one.
There isn't. And I think it's because the parties were developmentally different, especially by like the 1980s and 1990s. The Republican Party was becoming a party held together by ideology. And the Republican Party was still the Democratic Party was still a pretty diverse coalition of interest. And it is harder to message to a coalition of interest with fiery, outrageous, hot kind of media. And I think that was a real challenge, that the kind of the needs of the party and the needs of a profitable political entertainment complex, just they weren't the same.
It's much easier when you know for certain that 85% of your audience is a white guy, you know, between certain ages to, I guess, program to that.
Yeah, absolutely. It is. It's much more difficult with a diverse audience. And especially if you look at the Democratic Party, it is less ideologically diverse than it used to be, but it still contains lots of conservative and moderate voters who might share some of the ideological commitments or policy preferences of the Republican Party, but don't join the Republican Party because the Republican Party embraces racist policies or doesn't seem to have any interest in reaching out to, say, Black voters. So the Democratic coalition has always been much more diverse, not just in terms of race and ethnicity and gender, but also in terms of just ideological commitments and policy preferences. And that's much harder to message to.
So I know this is sort of outside your portfolio as a historian, but and I know that, but they, everyone's got to ask you this question. If there is a trajectory or a descent, I guess, depending on your perspective in terms of like where the Republican Party is headed, where like it's just picking up, it feels like the ball has been rolling down the hill and it's just picking up momentum. And there's been this shift, like you say, at one point. And really 9/11, I think, interrupted it on some level, although, yep. You know, Bush did not have he did not win the popular vote at all in 2000. We know at one point they moved into sort of a minoritarian sort of posture, like we're going to lead, even though we don't have as many people who want us to lead. We're going to figure out ways of doing it. Voter suppression, gerrymandering, rely on the Senate, Supreme Court, all those things, and maybe a little bit more. Where does it go? Like, how far can you take that without it? And maybe the real question is, like, without the next step being laws that, I mean, we see that in the context of like the Supreme Court doing this with gerrymandering, right? Like, they're a couple of steps away from basically saying, whoever controls the House, and literally there is no other principles associated with gerrymandering. You can't even have an independent commission. Like, the progression is they start to use the laws because they're running out of other sort of arrows in their quiver, right?
That's exactly right. And if you look at the incentive structures on the right, they are all pushing in the same direction. They are towards strengthening these counter-majoritarian institutions, which we've seen over the past many years. You know, when you see Republican state legislatures stripping governors of their power, and that's just how it goes, right? And it has not cost Republicans too much power, right? They might lose a few elections here or there, but in the long term, not only have they been able to retain hold on power, but they have been able to retain control of these institutions. And sometimes that breaks out into violence, like it did on January 6th. And the next step is to codify the aims of that violence into law. So people freak out about it a little less, right? It's very easy to pay attention to a big spectacle event like January 6th and be concerned about it and be terrified by it. But we don't have that same level of terror when state houses are passing laws in order to seize control of the electoral votes in their state. So I think that it is that kind of cycle of violence turned to law, all towards the end of retaining hold on power for the Republican Party, even at the cost of American democracy. And it is hard to see the Republican Party switching course because there are no incentives for them to switch course.
I have tunnel vision about this, and I think our audience knows that, but it feels like, you know, when you talk about that cycle of violence and then sort of like edify that with statue, it sounds like, you know, things were happening in Reconstruction in many of those southern states where there was this pushback to Black political power. It's a little bit it's a little disturbing. But
it's deeply disturbing.
With that said, Nicole Hemmer, it's a fascinating a history and an important one for people to understand. Professor of History at Vanderbilt University. The book is Partisans, the Conservative Revolutionaries Who Remade American Politics in the 1990s. We'll put a link to that at majority.fm. We'll put a link in the podcast and YouTube descriptions. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, folks, we will head into the fun half of the program now, where we will try and take a deep breath.
Yeah.
And forget, don't forget to go vote. Hope that was a slight encouragement to go out there.
I voted on Sunday. So, or no, Saturday I voted.
Suspicious. The story's already changing.
Yeah, weird. Yeah.
Oh, God.
Weird.
The anomalies are starting to pile up.
And my middle name is, yeah, right. That was, I don't know.
But, wow, that was weird. It's one of those days.
I think I did have.
We're gearing up for tomorrow. That's what's going on.
Right.
Let's see. Somebody had written about voting and said for those who I can't quite find it right now, but for those in the audience who eschew voting, here it is. Respectfully submitting a metaphor. This is from Matthew of Philadelphia. And of course, in Pennsylvania, extremely important to get out there and vote. Respectfully submitting a metaphor aimed at our comrades who eschew voting. Activism and organizing, not voting, is actually fighting the battle. But whether you have to fight the battle up a steep hill or a mountain is decided by elections. So vote. I think that's pretty good. I think that's a pretty good descriptor.
Yeah. Also, who's listening to this show on a daily basis about politics and just
not
like,
voting?
I'm
just
not going to vote.
Like, I don't know.
I mean, I don't think there's that many, but I would imagine there are many who have friends who feel that way.
And, you know, I mean, getting yourself to the polling place is one thing. And I understand that, you know, sometimes you have a full day and, you know.
Without a doubt. Without a doubt. And it's harder for some people than it is for others to vote. And some states make it even that much harder, et cetera, et cetera. So do your best. But, okay. Well, just a reminder, it is your, I mean, I don't know what else to say. Like, we're at that point now where it's a sort of, we're going to see what happens tomorrow.
I'm a nerd. Like, I think because I started voting in North Dakota when it was like, it doesn't matter who the Democrat is. Just like, you know, you get an opportunity to vote against like the Republicans who dominate the state. Just do it. But like, I like voting in New York. It's easy. Like, there's this school that's close to me that I like saying thank you to the poll workers. I'm like nerdy like that.
No, to me, it's like one of the few instances of like communal kind of contact with the rest of the people that live where you do.
Yeah.
To just you see people that live in your neighborhood at your polling place, and then you get the little sticker. I like that sticker.
Yeah.
I still like it. I still feel almost like the pain associated with not being able to vote against Reagan. I was 3 weeks late. I was born 3 weeks late. And if I had been born when I was due, back then they would let you really germinate in the womb back then.
You were like 3 weeks past your due date?
Yeah.
Holy cow.
Yeah. And they would let you like stew in there. And
then apparently,
you did. the story I heard was like, they, you know, like my mom and her friends and my dad and my mom and their friends would drive down roads that were really bumpy to try and jiggle stuff up. You know, technology wasn't quite what it was today.
Your brain the ramifications of that.
But I
day.
Was born on November 28th and I should have been born on November 7th, I think it was, or 6th, which would have allowed me to vote against Reagan in 1984, it was 88. 88, yeah. Wait, no, what?
Was it would have been 80. I think it would, or
it would have been 84.
No, 84, 18 was the voting age.
Because
and I missed it by
first,
3 weeks. Yeah, and I was so mad. Yeah. I was so mad. But
well, it would have
militant apathy
difference.
Says you really are old AF, bro. Yes, that's true. And I was really mad about it.
No,
I was, and it still rankles me, as you can see. But God damn it! Anyways,
Matt, were you old enough to vote before Obama?
Yeah, my first 2004? Vote was Obama 2008.
Okay.
Yeah, vote, folks. And you know, we got young people out there who I think it's also possible that if you're 18, 19, maybe you just don't think that there's any value to it. Believe me, you'll look back.
Yeah.
And if you're listening to this show at that age, I find it hard to believe, but go out and convince your friends. Mm-hmm. They're going to regret it. Some of them are going to regret it. The just a reminder, this show relies on your support. You can help the show survive and thrive by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only get the free show free of commercials, you get the fun half, wherein we have fun sometimes.
Yeah.
JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. You can now... I think they're now doing like personalized labels. I think I saw an ad for that. Did you see that? So where you can like put in a picture as like a gift.
Oh, that's really, that's a great,
like a picture of
gift.
Like somebody else and, yeah. And brand it. And so you can get the Majority Report blend, I think, but then put like Betty or Bill's picture on there, right. Or Betty and Bill if it's their anniversary, yeah. Or Bill and Bill, or Betty and Betty, and whatever it is.
A couple's gift, yeah.
Yeah, whatever. Emma, today is Monday.
Yes, so on ESPN, we will be talking about the downfall of the Green Bay Packers, and oddly, just like the steep drop-off for Aaron Rodgers this year, plus the surprisingly competitive game last night between the Titans and the Chiefs. We might go a little short today. We have election day tomorrow, and I'm moving next week, so I'm like, there's a lot of stuff going on. And but
short enough.
I
to
say
not
that,
that the Jets beat the Bills.
Yeah, Bradley might carry it by whoop whooping. But yeah, check us out youtube.com/ESVN show. Although we'll be on the Majority Report channel today. So I hate moving. It's like ruining my life, and I can't
It's one of the top three stressful things to do. Right,
worst thing to do.
Losing your job, moving, and a breakup. Right.
I mean,
that would make sense.
That would make sense. Yeah, but it is not fun, and it's because of the insane rental prices in New York that we got priced out. So what am I going to do except acquiesce?
Yep. Matt. What's happening in the Matt Leckie Media universe?
Yeah, for Patreons, actually for everybody. We released it early for patrons and for everybody on Sunday. A talk with Bronwyn Mehta. She's a PhD candidate at the University of Warwick. We talked about COP27, President Sisi's repression in advance of that, some political prisoner situations going on there. COP27.
Somebody's on a food strike, yes. a hunger strike. In
Ala Abdel Fattah, I think is his yes. name. We talked about him.
He's given up water like a week ago, right?
He's going to die unless there's an intervention. Yeah. We might talk with Bronwyn about some of his works. He has a collection of essays called You Have Not Yet Lost or something like that, or You Have Not Yet Been Defeated. But talk about him and Egypt in general, as well as we do a little bit of retrospective on the Tahrir Square and the post-revolutionary Egypt. So check that out, patreon.com/leftreckoning or on YouTube.
And that's a good reminder. We're going to be talking about COP27 later in the week, I think it is. We have a listener who's in attendance there, and we're going to be hearing from that person as well.
Earliest on Wednesday, yeah, we'll have him call in.
And also know that we're going to be covering the Israeli elections tomorrow. And I have to say, and I'll say this tomorrow, you know, I know all sorts of types of Jews, but I've heard from sort of staunch, like not right wing, but like, you know, strong supporters of Israel, people who are left leaning, still strong support of Israel. Just, I have never seen sort of such a universal acknowledgement of like, it's over. As this election has brought about.
Wow.
It really is fascinating because, and this is something that I think, you know, like for almost two decades and doing what I've been doing, I've been talking about it heading in this direction. And I think it is like we have crossed a threshold that I do not believe can go the other direction in terms of the Israeli body politic. But we will talk about that tomorrow. as we prepare to vote in this country. And of course, people have already voted and they're counting tomorrow, but they're not going to be done tomorrow. So, you know, this is just an excuse for you guys to watch me get drunk tomorrow night.
Well, yes, all of us will be engaging in that, or at least I will be. I'll be with you.
I'll be engaging in all sorts.
Yes, we'll be brothers in arms in getting drunk.
That's right. All right, 646-257-3920 is the number. We'll be taking phone calls and reading your IMs in the fun half. Goodbye. See you there.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun.
Oh, no. Are you ready?
Oh, yeah. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar! What a fucking nightmare!
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Danner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See, white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych. Fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back. And the Africans are black African. And the alpha males are black. And the Africans are back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keeping it 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back. Africans are black. Alpha males are black. Africans are back.
Come on.
Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total pussy.